Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode we have of Crime and Science Radio. Today's episode is called Money is the Root, Financial Crimes, with very special guest investigator Andrea Jacobson from the Alaska State Troopers Financial Crime Unit. So now, here's your host, Jan Burke.
Hi, it's great to be here with Andrea, who I met recently on a trip to Alaska for the Arctic Cliffhangers Forensic Foray Day. And as we started speaking, I decided what a wonderful guest you would make for our show. So welcome and thank you so much for being here, Andrea.
Oh, glad to be here too.
So, Andrea, one of the things we talked about while I was up there was that a lot of people who, even people who go into law enforcement, don't understand all of the connections financial crimes have to other types of crimes and how widespread their effect is and how much damage they do. So for just starters, could you talk a little bit about some of the kinds of financial crimes you see in your work and maybe also how they may be linked to other types of crimes and violence?
Well, I think that more and more people see the connection for sure between drug crimes and any other kind of crimes based on greed or financial crimes. But the other kinds of crimes are when you have situations where there's homicides for money, for insurance fraud. There was a recent case not too long ago that made national news involving a man named Levi Phillips that was the director of maintenance for Carson Helicopters. And back in 2008, in order to get this $20 million contract, they actually lied about the maximum weight and things in the helicopters, and it resulted in a horrible crash from him falsifying documents, and 9 people died in the crash. So they classified that as a fraud, but it was more like a homicide.
Wow. And that's a good example of how you don't always think about this, but someone just being greedy and filling out the paperwork for to kind of fudge things to his own benefit. I mean, $20 million, that's a prize a lot of people could understand somebody going after. So.
Right, and some frauds don't even involve money, but they're still they have a major impact, and some of that impact could be financial. One of the cases I worked was where a person that worked for one of the unions was trying to organize the university system. The university had, I think it was about 2,600 people in the bargaining unit. And what this person did was she, in order to unionize, you have to fill out an interest card, and then if there's 30% of the bargaining unit that have completed these interest cards saying they were interested in forming a union, then they can hold an election. The elections don't have to be a majority of the bargaining party. The elections just have to be a majority of the people who actually show up to vote. So in other words, if only 12 people out of the 2,600 voted and 6 of them wanted to be in the union, that would win. So what she did was she forged the interest cards so that it would seem like there was more than the 30% that they needed. And she did some other things. The ramifications of that is not just that there would be an up or down vote of the union, but that if the university ended up being unionized, even though not everybody wanted to be in the union, it would bring in, that unionization would bring in $1.5 million a year to the union. And that's a huge amount of money taken out of the paychecks of these university employees if they didn't want to be unionized. Mm-hmm. So that kind of fraud, although it has a financial root to it, it was really, you know, way more complicated and seemed more that somebody was just trying to, and for her, just to bring in business to make herself look better for her job.
Now, how is something like that usually detected?
Well, this one involved another employee that saw what was going on and mm-hmm. raised a flag. And in most fraud cases, it's especially with occupational fraud, it's the employees that notice those things. And you know, one of the biggest types of financial frauds that I investigate is embezzlement, which they have different names for it in different states, but pretty much everybody understands the word embezzlement. And now they call that type of fraud that's based on people who work in an environment or insider-type situations, they refer to it as occupational fraud. And that is huge. I mean, within the United States alone, I think the last time they calculated the figures, about 5% of the annual revenue from most organizations is lost to fraud each year. And that total for the United States, or it would equal, actually it was for the 2011 gross world product, it was $3.5 trillion of fraud that happens through occupational fraud.
Yeah, there's a lot of things I think many people would rather spend their money on than having it go into the pockets of somebody who's not above board. So, yeah, that's a huge dent. I mean, and obviously has an effect on companies' ability to use their money in better ways as well.
Well, sure, because when a business loses money, and you know, they don't like doing that, so they have a tendency to raise their prices. So you and I have to pay for their losses when they end up losing money. There are small businesses, though, that you really feel sorry for, because when somebody, it's a trusted employee usually that's been there quite some time, and when that employee does the damage they do to a company, some of them have to fold. Some of them have to file bankruptcy because they've made it absolutely impossible for the business to continue. And those are the ones you really feel sorry about, because there were some restaurants in town that I used to love to go to, but they had an evil manager one time, and then the next thing you know, the restaurant's closed.
Mm.
So, yeah, that just makes you angry at the person that is, you know, driving off into the sunset in their Escalade.
Right, and it hurts, I guess, you know, small businesses. I don't know if this is still true, but at least the last time I looked, they employ more people than large corporations if you take them all together. So when you stop to think about how people who may not be, you know, they don't have the resources to put together a security department, you know,
right,
to look for this kind of thing, or may not even be experienced in what to look for, or how to prevent it, they fold, and then all those, not only do you lose your restaurant, but everyone employed there is losing their job. So,
yeah, it's really devastating. And I think everybody at one point or another has been touched by some sort of fraud or scam, or they know somebody that has. It can be something simple, like when the people call you on the phone to solicit money for a charity, but they're really not a charity. Just about anything can actually trigger somebody trying to get money for nothing. And there are so many different ways to do it. It's almost impossible. I think the one of the biggest, most popular scams that's going around right now is through Craigslist and those types of online shopping. And for some reason, this happened when the Internet Crime Complaint Center used to send us the daily amount of people that were complaining about fraud taking place. A lot of the military members were targeted as people, you know, they just used real names of real military members to post an ad on Craigslist to sell a car. And the car would be a really good deal. But in the ad, they said that this particular military member was about to be deployed, and they needed to hurry up and sell the car. But it would be a, yeah, they have a 5-day review period where they would give your money back if you didn't like it. And because they were all the way up in Alaska, the military would put the car on a C-130 plane and send it to your state. And that way it wouldn't cost anything for shipping. And I can't tell you how, it was almost $1 million worth of the same Chevy Tahoe being sold over and over again.
Oh, my.
And one time, yeah, they even used an 18th century poet as the name of the officer, you know. But, again, people are falling for these things because they want a good deal. And it was, you know, they thought, wow, I can get this for $6,000 less than what I'd have to pay here, plus they'll deliver it.
Yeah, you know, that is a strange thing. I know even in the dating list, I know several women who've told me that they get these scams. Photos of men who are supposedly in the military. So I wonder if there's something about that where they feel that people will feel this is patriotic and, you know, trustworthy because they're going to be able to find this person through the military if there's some problem, not realizing they aren't, you know, it's just a catfish kind of situation.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, it is. In fact, I got several calls from the military members in the Craigslist scams. I got calls from them saying, what can I do? Because these people are threatening to call my commander, thinking that I'm the one that defrauded them out of their money. And it was me. You know? So that's an identity theft issue then.
Yeah. And that, I think, most people are aware now. But that's once that gets going, that's hard to backpedal out of. Or to clear and reestablish yourself as who you actually are at that point.
Yeah, there have been some real horror stories about identity theft. But we have better laws now, but it is still pretty easy. People are even, you know, taking old hotel room cards and bleaching them out so that they can print fake IDs on them, you know, and it's just pretty amazing what, you know, as fast as we can come up with ways to stop them, they're creating clever ways to defraud other people or to steal their identities. Sadly, the most horrible kind of identity theft I've run across, and it's happened several times, is where a father and son will have the same name, you know, because there's a junior added to one of them, and one or the other of them decides to take on, you know, their son's or father's identity and steal them from them. And it's just really a sad thing because it's all in the family.
Is it true that a lot of this kind of crime takes place within families? I mean, I've heard that sometimes, especially the elderly, are subject to this by, they're perhaps not as internet savvy or whatever. They're unaware that their nephew is online, or grandmother's unaware that their grandson or granddaughter is abusing her identity and credit cards or whatever. But, you know, and then there's the problem for law enforcement of trying to get her to, you know, proceed with the charges at that point.
There's sort of three different avenues there. Sometimes they abuse them through duping them into just signing over property, or sometimes just stealing out of their pocketbook kind of thing. And then when it is discovered, they tend to blame strangers, or they blame other things or other people, and that makes the grandparent or the elderly person even less likely to want to cooperate. And sooner or later, they find out they have nothing, and they don't even have their house they live in anymore because it was quit claim deeded to somebody else. The same kind of issues that would go with a power of attorney. I had a power of attorney for an 89-year-old woman one time that decided they would, rather than pay her rent on the apartment that they were supposed to help her make payments for, they just decided to go to Disneyland instead. So she, fortunately, there was an ombudsman that was able to intervene and help her out, but she did end up having to move into a facility because it's just so difficult to find people that are trustworthy at times.
And I'm sure in the facilities as well.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
It's a little harder
yeah.
with a facility, but in
yeah.
terms of stealing anyway.
Right, but. Right. Stealing property, I'm sure that's much harder. But so this also, as you had sort of mentioned at the beginning, there's also a huge part of this that is connected with these crimes that are connected with money laundering and with the drug trade. And so what are some of the, I mean, I'm not, in Alaska, you're, I mean, like everywhere else in the U.S., you're as subject as to anywhere, but you also have a closer connect, you know, it may not be the usual Mexico route, but it might be, say, in Southern California or Arizona, but are you still getting, you know, drugs shipped up there from south, or are they coming from other places as well?
Everywhere.
yeah.
And sometimes we make our own. There was a very big marijuana ring that was broken up about 3 years ago. And the way that one started was through a money laundering case from a bank. And in that situation, it was so classic, you would think somebody would have noticed this sooner. But they were this organization had a 17-year-old girl from the Ukraine making the deposits into the bank for a business. Tens of thousands of dollars a week, you know. And, of course, if you're depositing cash, sometimes if you keep it under the reporting limit, you don't have to complete the currency transaction reports or CTRs from the banks. But sometimes they would and sometimes they wouldn't. But the point was is that it wasn't a cash business. It wasn't a business that does a lot of volume in cash. So just by fact that it's a business account and there's a lot of money coming in on a regular basis doesn't mean it's okay. And somebody should go, well, wait a minute. Don't people pay for car repairs with credit cards and checks? They don't normally spend the hundreds of dollars it costs to fix your car with cash. But there were a lot of 20s, a lot of 50s. And so pretty soon somebody notices that this isn't a normal kind of transaction. And when you look closer, that you see all sorts of other things going on in the business that would raise eyebrows. It turns out over this particular group of people, over the course of a 2 or 3 year investigation of this group, one of the main players murdered one of the other main players. So there was a lot of intrigue involved in this giant case, but a lot of the drugs were coming from Canada. And they smuggled them through secret compartments and vehicles. And it was a very large case. They ended up seizing over $10 million worth of property, including gold coins or gold bullion and race cars, speedboats, Escalades, guns, and all sorts of things. So they managed to, it was a joint effort between the state troopers and the DEA. The federal agencies have the decent money laundering statutes, whereas most states don't have their own. And wire fraud and money mail fraud and money laundering are all the really good tools for the federal government. And a lot of the state agencies and local agencies are able to work with the federal government to pursue the big kind of cases involving those things.
I think maybe this would be a good thing to talk about, too. I think some people have this idea that these crimes are pursued because there's prize money for the agencies that comes out of the sale of these goods. Does that work the way people imagine it does, or is it a little more difficult?
It is kind of, I mean, they've made, actually they create forfeiture laws for that reason, so that we can recoup the costs of doing investigations. But I don't think that there's a police department or any kind of agency ever making a ton of money off of just investigating these kinds of cases. However, the equipment that is used is expensive, personnel, overtime, all of those things. It costs a lot of money to do a major investigation. And if some of the costs can be offset by the sale of assets, that's nice. But I think the real goal is that one of the biggest thing I've noticed about drug dealers is that they love stuff. They love their bling. And if you take it away from them, they are madder than if you sentence them to 15 years in jail. They'll do their jail time, but they want their stuff. So I think that taking it away from them and not letting them profit from it is just really probably the best aspect of their punishment, more than, you know, trying to, you know, get a lot of money for agencies.
So I'm sensing there's a little enjoyment in relieving them of their bling at that point and watching that reaction.
Yeah. In fact, another department I worked at in Ketchikan, Alaska, we seized a giant Suburban when it was brand new. In fact, the guy had just bought it and had only made a few payments on it, still owed lots and lots of money on it, and decided to make a drug transaction in the Suburban. So we seized the Suburban, and not only does he not have it and still has to pay for it, but we repainted it and used it as a school resource car, and I think we got a personalized license plate that said seized on it. So.
Excellent. Well,
yeah, I like that.
Although, as our last episode, as you mentioned, there's a very serious side of this. In fact, as you may be aware, in L.A. we just had a homicide, and certainly not the only one, but a homicide, I'm sure you know, but there's a homicide connected with someone who thought he could buy an iPhone inexpensively, and all the details are yet to emerge, but supposedly they're alleging that a couple of teenagers, you know, just set this guy up, something went wrong, and they shot him and his son. The son is, was horribly wounded, but is surviving, but saw his father killed, and this was nothing more than a couple of people who wanted a deal on a phone. So what are some of the things that people, you know, can do just to... We'll talk more about this, I think, in the next segment. But just let's say for Craigslist, for starters, what are some things people can do to keep themselves from being victimized?
Well, I think the best thing to do, first of all, since most of the fraud that takes place through those kinds of things are done long distance, the kinds of things that happen, like the cell phone family, those are extremely rare. And, you know, outside of, you know, just suggesting that they meet in a large public place, there's hardly any way to really judge that. You want to make sure you go into a certain place that's safe, but if you're trying to buy a couch or something like that, you're going to have to go into a place. But bringing people with you is always a good idea for that kind of thing. But in terms of the long-distance kind of scams that people do on those kind of things, the way to be safe is, first of all, try not to buy anything unless it's local. You want to be able to see it. There are people that are selling diamond rings and you know, really expensive items, and they're trusting that when they see this picture of it online that it's actually what it says it is. Mainly because the people tell you that it is. This is certified. I'll send documents. Well, documents can be forged. But they send their money out, and once they wire it, it's gone. And they may never get the package, or they may get the package that's full of something bogus. But, you know, in the long run, they didn't get to see it and touch it and feel it. So some people, if they're selling on Craigslist, have also run into this problem where people, it's what they call overpayment fraud. And with overpayment fraud, you're selling, let's say you were selling a banjo, and somebody sends, you know, you're selling it for $1,000. Somebody sends you a check for $2,500 and says, that's just to cover the cost of the shipping, and then you can just send the banjo to me, and then whatever's left over, you can wire it to me. Well, the people do that, and then it turns out that the check was a counterfeit check, and by the time it comes back from the bank as being counterfeit, then they've lost not only the money from their account from that check, but the money they spent to ship the banjo, and the banjo is gone.
Mm. So you're out.
Really, if you
not
can,
only your
yeah,
goods, so, but more than that.
Right.
No.
So if you can deal with some people locally, that would be the best thing. If you're selling something right on the ad for local customers only, Don't agree to mail anything, you know, with the promise that it's going to be, you know, shipped back to you. It's really kind of a tricky thing these days. PayPal makes it easier, but even PayPal accounts have been hacked through, you know, what they do is they create a fake website that looks like PayPal, and they say, you know, it's time for you to re-enter your password, and people just do it. You should never click on a link on a spoofed website or anything like that. That if you don't go to their website the way you normally do, then, you know, don't click on the links that people send you in emails.
Mm. Yeah. And also, I'm assuming you want to be careful about what types of information you give to someone, even what might seem like a legitimate sale.
Right. You know, when people pay by checks, people don't use checks very much anymore, and that's probably a good thing. Nowadays, so many people, even at garage sales, have that little square they put on their cell phones and use that for transactions. But the checks that you write and you send in, those have your account number on the bottom, and it's easy to go down to the office supply store and buy check stock and the VersaCheck program and just make your own checks once you have an account number. You can change it to where it has your name on there, and that way if somebody asks for ID, you'd have it, but pretty much you could paper a town in a weekend just making your own checks. Most people that are a little more careful now with taking checks because it is so easy to abuse them, but there's a lot of information when you're making transactions that go out there. I think it's probably, you know, you're less concerned about your email address because those can be changed, and even phone numbers aren't particularly worrisome. But anytime you send photographs online or post them online, there is EXIF data that you can find on the photograph. So if you are going to post something with a photograph, even if it's in your social media, you should probably make it a PDF before you put it on the website so that it strips it of the EXIF data. Otherwise,
okay,
they can find out where the picture was taken.
Right. Let's talk more about that in the next segment. We're coming up on break here.
Just can't breathe out on the floor.
everybody, after the break to Crime and Science Radio. And again, here's your host, Jan Burke.
Hey, I'm talking with Andrea Jacobson of the Financial Crimes Unit of the Alaska Bureau of Investigations, which is part of the Alaska State Troopers. I have to tell you, I was recently in Alaska, love the Alaska State Troopers, good folks. I met some really wonderful people while I was up there, and that was in part due to your help, Andrea, so thank you so much for that. And just recommend all of you who haven't been to Alaska yet, make the trip. It's a fabulous, fabulous place. And it has, I guess, its own unique challenges. One of the things being that it's a big place, right?
So, oh, yeah. There's plenty of room for more visitors.
Right. Well, and now, so we were talking a little, just to kind of go back really quickly to what we were talking about before. You were mentioning that when people put photos up on social media like Facebook or places like this, there's metadata embedded in these photographs that may have information off their phones or whatever that they really don't want out there on places like this. So you were saying to make a PDF of your photo first.
You can do that, or you can even strip, on some of the phones, there's a way to strip the GPS locators and things like that so that none of that is on there. But if you don't want to do that or you don't want to figure it out, then making it a PDF would do that for you fairly easily. It's really important when you're posting your kids' pictures online for your family and stuff, and you don't have your settings locked down and, those are out there. People know where your house is. They know, when it was taken. Also, if you're trying to make sure that you have your good excuse for not showing up at work, that, you didn't have the picture taken last year of your wrecked car that, is why you couldn't get to work on time. So those kind of things are handy to know. So
You can be busted in more ways than one, right?
So. Well, actually, that the case I mentioned earlier about the woman that was trying to unionize, another thing that she did was that she'd filed a union petition in that case and then texted a photograph of the interest cards and the petition to her boss to say she had filed this in time and that she was so happy about that. Well, when we did the search of her house and got her computer, there was these phone backup where it had the pictures on there, and looking at the exit data, the pictures were taken after she said she had dropped them off and after the close of business for that day, so there was no way that it could have been time-stamped the way she had forged the timestamp, So it was the photographs and the exit data that proved her to be a liar in that instance.
Now, did you have to become a computer expert to do what you do?
Oh, no. You don't even have to be an accountant, because people always try and accuse me of wearing a pocket protector or something, but that's not true. You don't have to do any of those things. You have to be logical, and in terms of doing computer forensics or cell phone forensics, we have specialists that can do those things, and oftentimes I'll go through the computer myself because I'm looking for text messages or something else that I know what to look for. I had a real estate case where I was looking for specific documents on it. And so they can teach me how to review it. But in terms of actually creating the carving out the data and things like that, although I've done it, with a great big amount of help, that is not my forte. It's just that there's a lot of people that are very good at that. And the programs they use these days are truly amazing, and a lot of it's done by just knowing how to use the equipment that it's available to law enforcement. So you don't have to be special to do it.
Right, but that is, for those of you who are talented in this area, that's a growing area in forensic science, is computer forensic science. And just as you were saying earlier, keeping up with that electronic frontier out there and
right.
The wild
and I
west
think,
that it is.
Yeah, there's a lot to know. I mean, not just the kinds of things that, you know, you are most afraid of, that, you know, somebody's going to crawl inside your computer and wipe your bank accounts out. It's, you know, way easier for, you know, to tell you the newest thing out right now is those QR codes
mm-hmm.
that look like the little square box with a weird little matrix in them. When you use your smartphone and you sort of take the picture of that, it puts you into a link. Well, they're now doing hacking into the QR codes, and some people call it, I think they call it click hacking. And what they do is they can put a sticker with their own little QR code over top of the ones that are in public places, like on posters and things.
Mm.
So before you put your cell phone up to one of these posters, you might want to just see if there's a sticker and don't shoot it. Don't, you know, click on it if it happens to be a sticker, because that means somebody might have tried to alter what the original person has put up there. And it could take you to not only a spoofed website, it could also embed a Trojan onto your device.
Mm. So even more fun.
Yeah.
So you also, when we were talking, mentioned to me that charities also get affected by financial crimes. I think people don't always realize how vulnerable sometimes organizations that are set up to do good can be, because, well, in part because they're easier depending on volunteers. But what are some of the kinds of things you've seen there?
Well, the average, when you're looking, when you're thinking embezzlement or somehow, you know, some fraudster, one of the things that's a kind of a profile of the average fraudster is a middle-aged woman working for a nonprofit. And sadly, that's a kind of a broad thing, but the numbers are really tilted in that direction right now. The reasons are because there are a lot of volunteer help. They're all in a trusting environment anyway. This is an organization that does, you know, tries to do good things for the community or good things for animals or people. And yet, you know, so people that work in those kind of places usually have big hearts and they want to trust people. And they have very lax controls. So when it comes to their finances and their bookkeeping, it's usually a small organization. They don't have, you know, unless it's United Way, which is giant, they're going to have just a handful of staff. And if they don't do their controls correctly, it just takes one person with a crisis at home or a gambling streak or an addiction problem or just a greedy person to, you know, wipe out any amount of money from an account in so many different ways. When a small organization depends on volunteers, they are usually not in a position to want to make a lot of restrictions on them, because they're afraid they'll lose their help. When you have a paid employee at a nonprofit, they're not making a lot of money, so you think they're doing it based on whatever the goal is of the organization, you know, that maybe they have the same ideals and that's why they're working for low pay. But it can also be that that person is in that organization because it is so ripe for the picking. They have a QuickBooks program, and who puts the information into QuickBooks? The bookkeeper does. And accountants or people in the accounting department also make up a very large percentage of the occupational fraudsters. The once that you get the QuickBooks documents, if the owner, manager, or even a board of directors is to look at that, they'll look at it and say, oh, it looks like we're doing great. But the numbers are fake because it's garbage in, garbage out. And whatever they want to type into the little boxes there that may or may not have any basis in reality. So somebody that is, you need to separate duties, have two people that are able to handle that. One person can reconcile the account. One person can make the entries. Maybe another person can issue payments or make deposits. But those job duties should be rotated every now and then. And in fact, a lot of frauds are discovered when the one doing it goes on vacation. one of the traits of embezzlers is that they don't ever want to take vacation because their kingdom might collapse while they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a case where it wasn't a nonprofit. In fact, it might surprise you, but it was actually a clerk of the court, and one of the court clerks they were taking in bail money, and they lock it in the safe, and then when the person, you know, their time comes up and bail is to be exonerated, they take it out and return it to them. Well, this person had her own sort of lapping scheme going. A lapping scheme is where you take new money and you replace stolen money, and then you have to keep covering for it. So when more bail money would come in, she can pay back the older bail money that she took.
A cash-based Ponzi scheme, in a way.
Those are designed to fail. But she had, at one point, was over $212,000 of money that she had taken, and she was trying to steal it, more bail money to put back, and she had this elaborate schedule of when their court cases were coming up and when they might get their bail exonerated. But then her son had a tournament that she wanted to go to, a taekwondo tournament or something, and she went to Korea. Well, while she was gone, some crazy judge decided to let somebody go and give them their bail money back, and when they went to pick it up, it wasn't there. And that was just the whole way it crumbled, was because she was gone and couldn't cover it, couldn't figure out a way to get around it. So it was discovered while she was out of town, and that happens quite a bit.
I've seen, it's always sort of, and Kelly, maybe we could talk to you about sort of the personality of the people that end up doing this, but I mean, I've seen cases during the Crime Lab Project news, you know, that I go through. I'll see cases that just astound me. But there'll be things like, you know, programs to similar to Make-A-Wish, you know, but kind of providing things for terminally ill children, and you're thinking, how could you be so heartless as to, you know, skim off of something like this? But, you know, and then later the story comes out that this person is sort of maybe challenged at one point and just sort of knew how to get board sympathies of some. It sort of ended up just being the board, you know, ousting anybody that didn't like her.
Right.
So, you know, she knew how to manipulate the board, I guess, is and she was the only one in the office. So, So I've seen some of that. What kind of person is likely to get into financial crime?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different avenues. One of the most popular ones is that they have a bad history of dealing with money. They tend to spend more than they have, and they have high ideals, and they want nice things. And so it's the old, are they living beyond their means thing. And some people get so deep in the hole financially, they figure they'll just borrow money to make themselves solvent. And, of course, once they do it and they're successful, you know, they sort of say, well, I just need a little bit more. And then it becomes the situation where they actually almost enjoy it, but they can't get ahead, so they just keep doing it to cover their indebtedness. And that's never going to win. They're never going to be able to catch up to their likes. But a lot of times they will collect nice things along the way. So once what started out as just trying to cover a deficit now becomes a way to buy cool things. So a lot of times you'll see people living beyond their means, and that's a real red flag. Another one is if they have an addiction problem, and drugs are usually the common one, but it could be alcohol, it could be gambling. You know, any kind of an addiction issue will cause them to need more money than they are normally able to bring in. Then there's the ones that have family crises. You know, there's a lot of domestic violence cases that end up with the victim of the domestic violence being someone who turns to embezzlement because they are so restricted by their spouse as to what they're allowed to spend on groceries, or, you know, the kids can't participate in certain activities, and they just want to try and make their life better, and this is the way they've decided to correct that problem.
Wow.
And then they have and there's so many other, you know, reasons that people do it, but what we do know is that once they start doing it, the amount of money they steal tends to escalate. Most of that is because they realize they haven't gotten caught, and they just get better at it. Another thing is that when they do get caught, most of the time they're in an organization or a company, small or large, it's because of a tip. And that's why so many of the larger places now are paying to have a tip line in their organizations, because that is by far the way most fraud is caught, is by the anonymous tip.
Hmm. So
I sort of strayed again.
So there have to also be things. Well, no, I think this is really good. Is that part of what I'm thinking when you were talking earlier about the people who get caught up in this, is there ever a sort of sense of relief at being caught?
I would imagine so.
The pressure has got to be building alongside of all this. I mean, somewhere in their minds they have to realize that this is a house of cards.
Well, it is stressful for them, and especially if they've engaged in some kind of Ponzi or lapping scheme where they have to constantly take more money to pay off the previous people. And there was an office supply store secretary, and she was in charge of receivables. So when people would pay on their office supply bill, and this is back in the day when a lot of them used checks and things, she would make the deposits but would credit the money to an account that she had stolen from earlier.
Mm.
You know, somebody that would pay with cash, she would just pocket that and then try and get a check in and write on their balance sheet in the computer that they had made a payment when, in fact, it was somebody else's payment. So she had to keep stealing these payments from other people to credit the previous accounts, and it was stressful for her because it was going to collapse. She couldn't miss any. You know, she had to be there all the time
to make sure. Yeah, I mean,
you're right, and it was
stressful,
and she was very relieved when it all came crashing down.
Hmm. So, are people really punished for these crimes, or is it sort of something that, unless there's a case of a homicide or some other major crime attached to it, are they taken seriously by the courts?
It sort of depends. I mean, there's really, in general, I would say that property crimes would garner a lesser sentence than a crime of violence, and I think that's the way it should be. But on the other hand, sometimes they have these unrealistic notions that if once they've been caught, they're going to learn their lesson, and the humiliation and the probation hanging over their head is enough to deter them. But in fact, recidivism is probably greater with financial crimes if they don't receive, you know, any substantial punishment than with just about anything besides drunk driving. It is once they do it, they just keep doing it. It's sort of like their vocation. It's what they do, and they do it well. There's people that we put in jail, and if they do get in jail at all, as soon as they get out, they may even have conditions of their probation not to open a bank account or not to have a credit card, and that's the first thing they do. They go right from the jail to a bank, and it starts all over again. But most of the people who get caught, when they get caught the first time, they have a clean criminal history because they aren't career criminals. But even those people will do it again.
Mm. Now, I'm also sensing that there is something that you see in other criminal behavior where there's a pride almost. I don't think that's really the word I'm looking for, but where there's a sense of being smarter than other people, I'm assuming in some ways there are some of these people who've got to have the con artist working in them and are enjoying
that. Mm-hmm.
And view other people as suckers.
I think there's a certain percentage of those. And you know, one fellow, when I arrested him, he actually looked up at me and went, "You can't arrest me. I'm white collar." Which I thought was really funny. But he was one of those guys. He thought he was so smart that he could just, you know, get away with it. I think, but again, there's so many different kinds of people.
I hope he took his bling.
he was so far in debt that there was not much to take. But
okay. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
He was one of those that the humiliation factor was probably a deterrent. But I think that there are a lot of people that are like that, and they're usually the ones that are, in my mind, you know, pretty much fun to catch.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you got the other ones that are just they play dumb, or I think maybe even if they have access to a big pot of money, the big pot of money becomes intoxicating, and they sometimes just want to access it for the power of it. So I think there's a lot of different psychological reasons that people want to keep doing it, or they just can't stop themselves from doing it.
Mm-hmm. So not always just having a champagne taste and a beer budget, as my folks used to say about one of our relatives. Boy, am I going to get in trouble for having said that. But I do think, you know, from what you're saying, there's also sort of an, you know, when people hear the words financial crimes, they're kind of thinking that's happening maybe to people that, I mean, it's kind of like the reverse thing of that we just talked about, that the victims think they're safer than they are. So what are some kinds of things, we mentioned the things about Facebook, what are other things people need to be on the alert for, since, you know, as you're saying, a lot of this is getting caught internally. What would be some flags for the average person?
Well, for consumers, I think if they're purchasers of anything, to make sure that it's not too good to be true, because time and time again, it's things that were a screaming deal, you know, and they thought they were just the luckiest people in the world to get to be able to buy something that cheap that's what they want, and it doesn't happen very often, you know, that way. So I think just kind of having a more realistic approach to, you know, being a good consumer. And in terms of being a good employee, if you see something that just doesn't seem right to you, chances are you're the one that has the best view, and you need to speak up. So I think, again, even looking at your coworkers and seeing somebody do a little something wrong, that person has to get called on it right then before it leads to something way bigger. I mean, if you have a coffee fund and you know that it's Joe that always dips in the coffee fund, and, you know, if that doesn't get stopped, then what's Joe going to do next, you know? Then if you're a boss, if you're the owner, if you're in management, you have to set an ethical tone from the top down. If you know that, you know, you're not going to tolerate any kind of theft, whether it's you're cheating on your time card, whether it's, you know, using company property as your own or anything like that, you have to set the tone that that's not tolerated and that you value, you know, good, honest employment. And I think that will help stop a lot of the occupational fraud that goes on, is to make sure that you can't have your situational ethics. It has to be, you know, you either are or you aren't,
mm-hmm.
like being
mm-hmm.
pregnant. So I think having a good ethical management program, and then again, as if you are responsible for young people or elderly people, to make sure that they're not being conned, and to make sure that despite their pride, they need to report it, and they need to make sure they talk to somebody about what's going on.
Right. I can see, you know, where people are going to want to not want a family member to have a criminal record, but there may also be a point at which you're stopping this person from getting into, they've already crossed that boundary, I guess, is what I would say.
Mm-hmm, right.
They're already there, and you know, you're going to end up encouraging them to get in the kind of trouble that the family can't help them get out
of. Yeah. And even people that have been scammed, if they don't report it and they don't tell their friends, a lot of them are too proud to do that. They don't want to admit that they fell for some scam, you know. But on the other hand, they're the best teachers. I mean, if they're telling all of their friends, you know, look what happened to me. You know, I made a bonehead decision, but it cost me a lot of money, and I want to make sure that you don't make that same bonehead decision. So if, you know, you tell your friends, even if it's a little embarrassing, it will help you get better, because you might not recover from your loss. You may never get your money back, but you can stop somebody else from losing theirs. And then you're a hero. You're not a person that just...
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's excellent advice, and we're going to end the program on that great advice. I guess I will start by confessing that, you know, you can't smell things on eBay, so I did buy the stinkiest typewriter ever sold in America. So keep these things in mind that Andrea said about buying local and seeing the goods before you purchase them and so forth. And thank you so much, Andrea, for taking time at the end of a long day, I'm sure, to come and talk to us here on Crime and Science Radio. And we want to encourage everyone to tell your friends about the program. Remember that we can be downloaded after the show airs. Thank you very much, Andrea.
Thank you.